This is a Trinity Fellowship at Indiana University event. For more information about the Trinity Fellowship, please visit our website at tfiu.org.
Okay, well, hi, everybody. Today, as I'm sure you all know, this is our second installment on the topic of New Testament reliability and canonicity. Bob is not able to be here today because he and Brenda are off on vacation somewhere, I think.
In Florida.
In Florida? Oh, great place to be on vacation.
Hopefully
at the moment.
South Florida?
Orlando, I believe. So
we're south of Pensacola.
Yeah. Yeah. So so Bob is not here, but we have a pastor here anyway, so we're okay. Last time, Bob gave us an introduction to this issue of New Testament reliability and canonicity. He focused more on reliability, things like how many manuscripts do we have in the New Testament, how old are those manuscripts, how complete are they, how many quotations from the Old Testament do we have in the writings of the early church fathers, stuff like that. So it's a little bit more statistics. And also talking about sort of big picture issues. Does it matter if we know what the canon is? You know, why does it matter? What would be some objections to worrying about it? What are some answers? You know, why we should care about it? So I'm not going to deal with any of that stuff. Bob dealt with that last time. Today, and then 2 weeks from now, I'm going to be leading the discussion and we'll be going through some source materials and looking at what did the early church fathers themselves have to say about the New Testament canon. And so I'm not really talking about reliability. This is just about the canon and how the canon developed. Today, we're going to focus on what Eusebius, the church historian, had to say explicitly about the New Testament canon. Next time, we will look at three exemplars of church fathers from before Eusebius' time and look at what they had to say explicitly about canonical New Testament scriptures. We're not going to talk about all the quotations from early church fathers. Quotations of New Testament scriptures. There are tons of them going back to the first century. But we're not going to talk about the quotations. We're going to talk about explicit discussions of what is Holy Scripture. Okay? And you have several handouts, four handouts to be precise. One is, it's this one, it says Ecclesiastical History at the top. This is an excerpt from Eusebius' church history. We'll start with that, but I want to give you a heads up on these other handouts. The second handout, it's got a picture of a book on the top. This, we'll also take a look at this. This is called the Muratorian Canon. And this is actually the oldest explicit listing of New Testament books that we know of. But we'll get to that in a bit. The next handout is, it says early canon lists at the top. This is not exhaustive, but it is a handful of canon lists from about 300 AD to about 400 AD. We'll talk a little bit about that. The last handout is, it says approximate timeline. So there's a little graph on the left that just indicates when these dates actually occurred. The dates corresponding to those little lines is in the next column, and the actual event described is in the right column. Let's start here just for a moment, okay? Just to get our bearings. This is from the birth of Christ to the Council of Nicaea, which is often thought of as sort of a turning point in studies of the canon of the New Testament. Birth of Christ happened about 4 BC. The crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension happened in about 30 AD. The earliest New Testament writings, I wrote 55, I should have written 50 A.D., thereabouts. Books like Galatians, James, 1 Thessalonians, maybe Matthew or Mark are written around this time. Those are at least all, those are the traditional dates. the destruction of Jerusalem happens in 70 A.D., and the last, or the latest New Testament writings happen probably in the 90s. Okay, that would be the Gospel of John, John's letters, and there's a lot of debate about whether Revelation was written at this time or maybe 20 years earlier. But anyway, there's where the New Testament writings that made it into the canon, those were written between about 50 and 90 A.D. 115 A.D. is about the time of the earliest New Testament papyrus manuscript that we have. That's the one that we had a little bit of discussion about last time. It's a fragment of the Gospel of John at the University of Manchester in England. 155 is a red letter year. 155 is approximately the date of the martyrdom of Polycarp, who was a disciple of John the Apostle. 180-ish is when Irenaeus, the disciple of Polycarp, wrote his book Against Heresies. And that book will occupy some of our attention 2 weeks from now, because he has some things to say explicitly about the canon, particularly the Gospels. The year 200 AD is, for this next item, very approximate. 200 AD is probably at the latest when the Muratorian canon was written. That was that second handout that I told you about. It's probably closer to 180 AD, although we really don't know for sure. Tertullian wrote a book called Against Marcion sometime around 210. That's, again, a very rough date. And that will occupy some of our attention 2 weeks from now because of what he has to say about the canon. Origen wrote commentaries on Matthew and John and all sorts of other stuff in the middle, first half to middle of the third century. So I put 240 AD. That's a rough round number just to get you in the ballpark. Origen died probably in about 250, 255, somewhere in there. And Origen will occupy our attention next time. Finally, 313 AD. I've got a couple things listed for that date. One is Eusebius' Ecclesiastical History, which is the excerpt that you have in the first handout. We don't know exactly when the Ecclesiastical History was written. It was probably published in batches, in installments. One of the theories is that it was published in 313 AD originally, and a couple books at the end were added on maybe 10 years later. But it was somewhere around that time that Eusebius wrote his Ecclesiastical History. 313 AD was also the year of the Edict of Milan, which is Constantine's edict making Christianity legal in the Roman Empire. So Constantine, I was putting this timeline together. Turn the recording off for this, right? I was putting this timeline together at the last minute. I did not double check when Constantine's conversion is thought to have happened. I don't recall now offhand if it was before or after the Edict of Milan, but it would have been around this time. 325 AD is when the Council of Nicaea happened. Okay. Those 2 points, the Edict of Milan and the Council of Nicaea, those are important for us because there is widespread misunderstanding about the relationship between the canon and Constantine converting to Christianity making Christianity legal, and presiding at the Council of Nicaea. There's a widespread, let's call it a rumor, that the Council of Nicaea in 325 is when the canon was officially canonized. But as you can see, Eusebius was writing his ecclesiastical history before the Council of Nicaea. And if he first published it in 313, he was certainly writing it before the Edict of Milan. So Constantine really, contrary to what a lot of people think, Constantine had next to nothing to do with the canon in deciding what the canon was. Okay, so those are just some important dates for you. And let's take a look at this excerpt from the ecclesiastical history of Eusebius. I'm actually going to read from a slightly different translation, just for fun. You can see what different translations sound like as you're reading along. We're starting with this. This is book three of the church history, chapter 24. And if you have some spare time and you want to check out chapter 23, which immediately precedes this, that's a pretty good story about John the Apostle. Okay, so chapter 23 is this story about John the Apostle, which is told by Clement of Alexandria. And Eusebius relates that story, and now he picks up in chapter 24. And again, I'm reading from a slightly different translation. This extract from Clement I have inserted here for the sake of the history and for the benefit of my readers. Let us now point out the undisputed writings of this apostle. He's talking about John in this instance. And in the first place, his gospel, which is known to all the churches under heaven, and it must be acknowledged as genuine. That it has with good reason been put by the ancients in the fourth place, after the other three gospels. So there he specifies three other gospels. This may be made evident in the following way. Those great and truly divine men, I mean the apostles of Christ, were purified in their life and were adorned with every virtue of the soul. But they were uncultivated in speech. They were confident indeed in their trust in the divine and wonder-working power which was granted unto them by the Savior, but they did not know how, nor did they attempt to proclaim the doctrines of their teacher in studied and artistic language, but employing only the demonstration of the divine Spirit which worked with them and the wonder-working power of Christ which was displayed through them. They published the knowledge of the kingdom of heaven throughout the whole world, paying little attention to the composition of written works. And this they did because they were assisted in their ministry by one greater than man, Paul, for instance, who surpassed them all in vigor of expression and richness of thought, committed to writing no more than the briefest epistles, although he had innumerable mysterious matters to communicate, for he had attained unto even the sights of the third heaven, had been carried to the very paradise of God, and had been deemed worthy to hear unspeakable utterances there. Referring there to Paul's own account in First Galatians, First Corinthians. Corinthians?
First or Second Corinthians?
One of the Corinthians. Thank you. And the rest of the followers of our Savior, the 12 apostles, the 70 disciples, and countless others besides, were not ignorant of these things. Nevertheless, of all the disciples of the Lord, only Matthew and John have left us written memorials. And they, tradition says, and this is tradition as of 313-ish AD, they, tradition says, were led to write only under the pressure of necessity. For Matthew, who had at first preached to the Hebrews, when he was about to go to other peoples, he committed his gospel to writing in his native tongue. and thus compensated those whom he was obliged to leave for the loss of his presence. And when Mark and Luke had already published their Gospels, they say that John, who had employed all his time in proclaiming the Gospel orally, finally proceeded to write for the following reason. The three Gospels already mentioned having come into the hands of all, and into his own too, they say that he accepted them and bore witness to their truthfulness. Okay, so that's the Apostle John himself, according to tradition at this time, putting his apostolic stamp of approval on Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But that there was lacking in them an account of the deeds done by Christ at the beginning of his ministry. And this is indeed true. For it is evident that the three evangelists recorded only the deeds done by the Savior for 1 year after the imprisonment of John the Baptist, and indicated this in the beginning of their account. For Matthew, after the 40 days fast and the temptation which followed it, indicates the chronology of his work when he says, "Now when he heard that John was delivered up, he withdrew from Judea into Galilee." Mark likewise says, "Now after that John was delivered up, Jesus came to Galilee." Luke, before commencing his account of the deeds of Jesus, similarly marks the time when he says that Herod, adding to all the evil deeds he had done, shut up John in prison. They say, therefore, that the Apostle John, being asked to do it for this reason, gave in his gospel an account of the period which had been omitted by the earlier evangelists and of the deeds done by the Savior during that period. That is, of those which were done before the imprisonment of the Baptist. And this is indicated by him, they say, in the following words. "This beginning of miracles did Jesus." And again, when he refers to the Baptist in the midst of the deeds of Jesus as still baptizing in Ainon near Salim, where he states the matter clearly in the words, "For John was not yet cast into prison." Okay, John, accordingly, in his gospel, records the deeds of Christ which were performed before the Baptist was cast into prison, but the other three evangelists mention the events which happened after that time. One who understands this can no longer think that the Gospels are at variance with one another, inasmuch as the Gospel according to John contains the first acts of Christ, while the others give an account of the latter part of his life. And the genealogy of our Savior according to the flesh, John quite naturally omitted, because it had already been given by Matthew and Luke. And he began with the doctrine of his divinity, which had, as it were, been reserved for him as their superior by the divine spirit. These things may suffice which we have said concerning the gospel of John. The cause which led to the composition of the gospel of Mark has been already stated by us in a different part of the church history. We'll skip ahead a little bit, talking about Luke, John, okay. And let's skip to chapter 25. Since we are dealing with this subject, it is proper to sum up the writings of the New Testament, which have been already mentioned. First, then, must be put the Holy Quaternion of the Gospels. So, in other words, there are four, and they are holy, sacred. Following them, the Acts of the Apostles. After this must be reckoned the Epistles of Paul. Next in order, the extant former epistle of John, that would be 1 John, and likewise the epistle of Peter, that would be 1 Peter. These two must be maintained. After them is to be placed, if it really seemed proper, the Apocalypse of John, that's Revelation, concerning which we shall give the different opinions at the proper time. Okay, so there are different opinions about Revelation. These then belong among the accepted writings. The Gospels, Acts, the letters of Paul, 1 John, and 1 Peter, and maybe Revelation. Among the disputed writings, which are nevertheless recognized by many, are extant the so-called Epistle of James, that of Jude, also the second Epistle of Peter, and those that are called 2 and 3 John, whether they belong to the evangelist or to another person of the same name. So there's some uncertainty about whether James, Jude, 2 Peter, 2 and 3 John are really supposed to be part of the canon or not. But many people do accept that. There's also uncertainty, at least on Eusebius' part, about whether John the Apostle wrote 2 and 3 John. But then he goes on. Among the rejected writings must be reckoned also the Acts of Paul and the so-called Shepherd. That's the Shepherd of Hermas. And the Apocalypse of Peter. And in addition to these, the extant Epistle of Barnabas. And the so-called Teachings of the Apostles. And besides, as I said, the Apocalypse of John, if it seemed proper, which some, as I said, reject, but which others class with the accepted books. And among these, some have placed also the Gospel according to the Hebrews, with which those of the Hebrews that have accepted Christ are especially delighted. And all these may be reckoned among the disputed books. Okay, so we've got the universally accepted books in 3:13-ish. The Gospels, Acts, the letters of Paul, 1 John, 1 Peter, maybe Revelation. Then you've got disputed books, which include 2 Peter, 2 and 3 John, James, Jude, and then you've got the just outright rejected books. The Acts of Paul, the Shepherd of Hermas, the Apocalypse of Peter, the Epistle of Barnabas, the Teachings of the Apostles, the Gospel according to the Hebrews, and maybe Revelation. He's got Revelation in two categories there.
Does he have Hebrews in two categories too?
So he talks about the Gospel according to the Hebrews, which is probably not our letter to the Hebrews.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, there's a different Gospel to the Hebrews that was very popular in some parts of the church in the early centuries. But it was never considered canonical by most people.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, is the Acts of Paul, is that Acts written by Luke, or is that a different?
That's a different, okay. Yeah, the Acts of the Apostles is our Acts, and that's one of the accepted writings.
And accepted by who?
Accepted by pretty much the entire church.
Okay.
Across the entire swath of Christendom at this time.
Okay.
Yeah. He doesn't explicitly mention the letter to the Hebrews. Interesting, huh? Probably because he considers Hebrews to be one of the epistles of Paul.
Okay. But he doesn't.
I'm sorry?
Romans?
That's among the epistles of Paul. So he just lumps all of the epistles of Paul together.
Like 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and all
that. Yeah. A lot of the early canon lists did that. They would just say the epistles of Paul, or the 14 epistles of Paul, if they counted Hebrews, or the 13 epistles of Paul,
if they didn't count
Hebrews. So sometimes they spell them all out, sometimes they...
So they think he wrote
much.
Hebrews?
Eusebius thinks that Paul wrote Hebrews, yes.
Is Hebrews mentioned elsewhere before Eusebius, or...
Yes, you said Hebrews is one of the most quoted books by some of the earliest church fathers.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Clement of Rome, who was a disciple of Peter and Paul, and was writing, he wrote a letter to the Corinthian church before John wrote the Gospel of John. And so, I mean, really early. And he loves Hebrews. He quotes from Hebrews all the time.
So that's been around.
It's been around.
Okay.
Yeah. Hebrews has been around. There's no question about its provenance. The only question is about who wrote it.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Let's see. We can go on. So he just said all these may be reckoned among the disputed books, but we have nevertheless felt compelled to give a catalog of these also. Distinguishing those works which, according to ecclesiastical tradition, are true and genuine and commonly accepted, from those others which, although not canonical but disputed, are yet at the same time known to most ecclesiastical writers. We have felt compelled to give this catalog in order that we might be able to know both these works and those that are cited by the heretics under the name of the apostles, which he hasn't mentioned yet, including, for instance, such books as the Gospels of Peter, of Thomas, of Matthias, or of any others besides them, and the Acts of Andrew and John and the other apostles, which no one belonging to the succession of ecclesiastical writers has deemed worthy of mention in his writings. And further, the character of the style is at variance with apostolic usage, and both the thoughts and the purpose of the things that are related in them are so completely out of accord with true orthodoxy that they clearly show themselves to be the fictions of heretics. Wherefore, they are not to be placed even among the rejected writings, but are all of them to be cast aside as absurd and impious. Okay, so some strong words there.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering what in these books or writings is making people look at it as something that shouldn't be canonized?
These last books?
Yeah.
I am not an expert on the contents of those last books, but I have some books here that include a lot of these rejected books. And if you'd like to take a look at some of them, you're welcome to. So, for instance, this book has, maybe Dan, you want to jump in on this. This has the Gospel of Pseudo-Matthew, the Gospel of the Nativity of Mary, the History of Joseph the Carpenter, the Gospel of Thomas, page 395. I, Thomas, an Israelite, write to you this account, that all the brethren from among the heathen may know the miracles of our Lord Jesus Christ in his infancy, which he did after his birth in our country. The beginning of it as follows. This child Jesus, when 5 years old, was playing in the ford of a mountain stream. He collected the flowing waters into pools and made them clear immediately, and by a word alone he made them obey him. And having made some soft clay, he fashioned out of it 12 sparrows. And it was the Sabbath when he did these things. And there were also many other children playing with him. And a certain Jew, seeing what Jesus was doing, playing on the Sabbath, went off immediately and said to his father Joseph, "Behold, thy son is at the stream, and has taken clay and made of it 12 birds, and has profaned the Sabbath." Joseph, coming to the place and seeing, cried out to him, saying, Wherefore doest thou on the Sabbath what it is not lawful to do? And Jesus clapped his hands and cried out to the sparrows and said to them, "Off you go!" And the sparrows flew and went off crying. And the Jews, seeing this, were amazed and went away and reported to their chief men what they had seen Jesus doing. That's the first story in the Gospel of Thomas. There's the Arabic Gospel, the Infancy of the Savior. There's all sorts of stuff in here.
Quite a few of these were rejected because they were clearly spurious in the fact that they claimed to be written by, say, Peter, but were written 50, 100 years after Peter had died. And so the church was quick to say, no, this is...
Yeah, yeah. All of the rejected writings, are... mostly written in the name of the apostles, they're all from at least the middle of the second century.
Okay.
So
all those guys were already dead.
All of those apostles were already dead. Yeah. The writings that were known to the church fathers that were contemporary with the last of the apostles. They were the epistles of Clement, Barnabas, Diognetus, Ignatius, Polycarp. Some of those epistles were very highly regarded in the early church and even were handwritten in early copies of the Bible at the end of the New Testament. In some of the earliest canon lists, there was some of these other books made it in.
So they weren't disputing them? At that time?
At that time, there was always some dispute, but the church had not come around to total agreement yet. Okay? But by the time we get to Eusebius, the church is in pretty good agreement about what we have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those apocryphal books are absolutely rejected. The books that are accepted, can I write over here?
The four Gospels, the Acts, the letters of Paul, 1 John, 1 Peter, these books are pretty much never disputed. Everybody, always, everywhere in the early church agreed and accepted that these are actual canonical books.
And you said Hebrews was included in that because of Paul.
Hebrews is often included in that because of Paul. Occasionally, Hebrews is disputed.
So, they counted, did you say they counted 13 or 14 letters?
That's right, that's right. Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, 1 and 2 Timothy, Titus, Philemon. That's 13. Hebrews is 14. As far as explicit statements of canonicity go, the earliest statements we have deal with the Gospels, and we'll talk more about that next time. But these books were universally, early on, accepted everywhere. And then there were some books that were, depending on who you asked and what part of the Christian world you were in, people had some differing opinions. So the remaining New Testament books, 2 Peter, 2nd, 3rd John, maybe Hebrews, James, Jude, maybe Revelation, those were still disputed for some time. And even in Eusebius' time, it's not universally agreed upon yet. Okay.
Just the Gospel of Matthew that it talks about in 25, that's a different Gospel of Matthew, right? Or it says Matthias.
Matthias, which was the...
I'm sorry, where was that?
...replaced Judas. I think he read in his. Yeah. Ours says Matthew, but you said Matthias.
At the end? Oh, yeah, I said Matthias, yeah. Matthias. That would have been the other guy who replaced Judas.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. That's Eusebius. And Eusebius is not necessarily always right about everything. But he's really good. He was one of the leading scholars of his day. He presided over a rich library, tons of resources, and he did a lot of work, a lot of research, talking to people, reading people's writings, reporting people's writings. A lot of what Eusebius reports and quotes from the earliest church fathers, we don't have those anymore. We only know about them because Eusebius quotes them. And so he does an amazing job. He has some funny ideas about whether Revelation and 2nd and 3rd John were written by the Apostle John. I think they're funny ideas, but a lot of people even today think that maybe there was a different John who wrote those. In any event, enough of Eusebius. Let's take a look at the Muratorian fragment. Okay, the Muratorian fragment dates from around 170 AD. In my timeline, I put 200 AD, but that's the absolute latest. We don't know exactly when it was written. Let's see here. Let's skip the preamble there and get right down to the to the middle of the page where it says the Muratorian Canon. And that first paragraph is just some stuff about the translation. Where it gets indented, starting with dot, 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 at which, nevertheless, he was present. That is the beginning of the text fragment that we have, which is called the Muratorian Canon. So, it starts in the middle of a sentence. We don't know what happened before, but it probably is talking about the Gospel of Mark. Dot, 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 at which, nevertheless, he, probably Peter, was present. And so, he, Mark, placed them in his narrative. So, Mark wrote the Gospel on the authority of Peter. The third book of the Gospel, okay, the third, so that presumes that we've got Matthew and Mark already discussed. The third book of the Gospel is that according to Luke. Luke, the well-known physician, after the ascension of Christ, when Paul had taken with him one zealous for the law, Luke composed it in his own name according to the general belief. It's a general belief, Luke wrote it. Yet he himself had not seen the Lord in the flesh, and therefore, he, as he was able to ascertain events, so indeed he begins to tell the story from the birth of John. The fourth of the Gospels is that of John, one of the disciples. By the way, why is he called one of the disciples and not one of the apostles? This is part of the fodder for the idea that this is a different person named John. Anyway, the fourth of the Gospels is that of John, one of the disciples. To his fellow disciples and bishops, who had been urging him to write, he said, "Fast with me from today to 3 days, and what will be revealed to each one, let us tell it to one another." Okay, in the same night, it was revealed to Andrew, one of the apostles, that John should write down all things in his own name, while all of them should review it. And so, though various elements may be taught in the individual books of the Gospels, nevertheless, this makes no difference to the faith of believers, since by the one sovereign Spirit, all things have been declared in all the Gospels, concerning the nativity, concerning the passion, concerning the resurrection, concerning life with his disciples, and concerning his twofold coming. The first in loneliness when he was despised, which has taken place. The second glorious in royal power, which is still in the future. What marvel is it then if John so consistently mentions these particular points also in his epistles, saying about himself, "What we have seen with our eyes and heard with our ears and our hands have handled, these things we have written to you." For in this way, he professes himself to be not only an eyewitness and hearer, but also a writer of all the marvelous deeds of the Lord in their order. Moreover, the Acts of all the apostles were written in one book. For most excellent Theophilus, Luke compiled the individual events that took place in his presence, as he plainly shows by omitting the martyrdom of Peter, as well as the departure of Paul from the city of Rome when he journeyed to Spain. As for the epistles of Paul, they themselves make clear to those desiring to understand which ones they are, from what place, or for what reason they were sent. First of all, to the Corinthians, prohibiting their heretical schisms. Next, to the Galatians, against circumcision. Then to the Romans, he wrote at length, explaining the order or plan of the Scriptures, and also that Christ is their principal or main theme. It is necessary for us to discuss these one by one, since the blessed Apostle Paul himself, following the example of his predecessor John, writes by name to only seven churches in the following sequence: to the Corinthians first, to the Ephesians second, to the Philippians third, to the Colossians fourth, to the Galatians fifth, to the Thessalonians sixth, to the Romans seventh. It is true that he writes once more to the Corinthians and to the Thessalonians for the sake of admonition. Yet it is clearly recognizable that there is one church spread throughout the whole extent of the earth. For John also, in the Apocalypse, though he writes to seven churches, nevertheless speaks to all. Paul also wrote out of affection and love, one to Philemon, one to Titus,
and two to Timothy, and these are held sacred in the esteem of the Church Catholic for the regulation of ecclesiastical discipline. There is current also an epistle to the Laodiceans and another to the Alexandrians, both forged in Paul's name to further the heresy of Marcion and several others, which cannot be received into the Catholic Church. For it is not fitting that gall be mixed with honey. Okay, so he knows in about 180, 170, that this person who wrote this canon knows that there are some forged epistles attributed to Paul and other epistles and books. And they have been forged in the name of the apostles to further the heresy of Marcion or other heretics of that time. These cannot be received into the Catholic Church. Moreover, the epistle of Jude and the two of the above mentioned, or bearing the name of John, are counted or used in the Catholic Church, and the Book of Wisdom, written by the friends of Solomon in his honor. Where's that one coming from? Okay. We receive only the apocalypses of John and Peter. Though some of us are not willing that the latter be read in church, the Apocalypse of Peter. By the time Eusebius is writing, the Apocalypse of Peter is one of the rejected books. But Hermas wrote The Shepherd very recently, in our times, in the city of Rome, while Bishop Pius, his brother, was occupying the episcopal chair of the Church of the city of Rome. That, by the way, is our principal reason for dating this so early, because he says here, The Shepherd of Hermas was written very recently during the episcopate of Pius in Rome. And therefore, it ought indeed to be read, but it cannot be read publicly to the people in church, either among the prophets, whose number is complete, that would be Old Testament, or among the apostles, that would be New Testament, for it is after their time. So he knows that the Shepherd of Hermas is after 50 to 100 years after the New Testament. But we accept nothing whatsoever of Arsenius or Valentinus or Miltiades, who also composed a new book of Psalms for Marcion, together with Basilides, the Asian founder of the Cataphrygians, End of fragment. Those are all heretics of the second century.
Do you know who is supposed to have write this fragment?
We do not know who wrote this fragment. The most frequently bandied about name is Hippolytus of Rome, who was a good guy. But honestly, we have no idea. This fragment is part of some medieval monk's book of devotionals, if you will, where he copied down various materials from various sources, mostly from early church fathers of the 4th and 5th centuries, I think. So later church fathers. But in the middle of it, he also copied down this. No context. We have no idea who wrote it. We only have the internal evidence that it was written toward the end of the second century.
And then in here it talks about how the shepherd should be read,
mm-hmm.
but just not listed among the Holy Scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
So is that like something like we should read?
So the early church, pretty quickly, I mean, this is by the time... before the end of the second century, so less than 100 years after the end of John's ministry, the early church has started making distinctions about what books are supposed to be read in public in the church services. What books are okay to read outside of that privately on your own for your own personal edification, but should not be read in church, and what books are
absurd and ridiculous and unholy, and that you just throw them away. The church starts making those sorts of distinctions very early on. This person, whoever it was, clearly thinks that the Shepherd of Hermas is a worthwhile book to read. Many of the early church fathers thought that the letters of Barnabas and Clement and Ignatius and Polycarp were worthy of being read and studied, but they were not part of the church services. The church services included readings from the Old Testament and from those books over there. And then some churches early on also read from the other New Testament books, and some of them didn't.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do we know anything about Hermas, who was supposed to have written the Shepherd?
Hermas was a, I believe he was one of the clergy in Rome. His brother was the Pope. He was the Bishop of Rome at this time. The Shepherd of Hermas, the Shepherd is an apocalypse. He has several visions and he talks about them. At one time or other, I have read bits and pieces, but I've never gotten through the whole thing. Have you ever read The Shepherd?
A long time ago.
Do you remember any of it?
Nope. And I got that one in the Didache, confused.
Okay.
Because they were both esteemed highly.
Yes.
But I can't remember.
Okay.
Much about either.
Okay. The Didache is more like point by point teachings.
Okay.
The Shepherd is the apocalypse with multiple visions and stuff. Does that help?
Yeah.
The contents are not there. Okay.
Yeah.
So again, I've got the Shepherd of Hermas up here if you want to take a look at it. And I think we probably have all these books in the church library as well.
I get my library card.
So those are a couple of early church lists. We can look at the third handout now.
So real quick,
yeah.
Any chance, he doesn't mention that I saw anything, any of the letters of Peter. Am I missing that?
He
mentions an apocalypse of Peter.
You are correct. And
in that weird wisdom, not much about,
right? Other epistles. The Muratorian fragment next mentions the epistle of Jude and two epistles of John. There's been much discussion whether the latter statement means 1st and 2nd John or 2nd and 3rd John. It's possible that since he had alluded to the first epistle before, he's okay, blah, blah, blah. Next follows an unexpected reference to the Book of Wisdom. Okay. Yeah, he does not mention Peter. Okay, books that are not mentioned in the list include 1st and 2nd Peter, James, and the Epistle to the Hebrews. So he lists out the epistles of Paul and does not include Hebrews. He's just got 13. of these, the most surprising omission is that of 1st Peter, in view of the rather extensive use made of 1st Peter by several early writers, both Western and Eastern. It may be, as Tan and others have supposed, that the list originally did mention 1st Peter, but through scribal carelessness, reference to it was accidentally omitted. The Muratorian canon, and this book of devotions that this monk wrote, was originally published as an excellent example, back in the 1700s when it was discovered, an excellent example of what sloppy, terrible jobs the scribes did copying out stuff from earlier. This is the poster child. Whoever it was, whatever monk wrote this book and included, copied out the Muratorian canon, he is the poster child for the scribe that you do not want to be. Okay? He's got, within the parts of his book that we do have, There are spelling errors left and right. There are omissions. There, he copies like a whole 30-line segment twice, and the two parts don't agree. There's lots of places where he messes up, and so that's why people have said it wouldn't be that surprising for this particular monk to have just skipped a line and not caught on that he missed Peter.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So that's sort of, I think, the prevailing wisdom. First Peter, in particular, was so highly regarded throughout the church. Yeah.
And so, just one last question.
Yeah.
If this is the copy from the monk,
uh-huh.
How do you know that the original one is dated to 150 or 170?
It's from the internal evidence about the shepherd of
Hermas. In our time. Okay, that's what I'm
saying. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we know when Pius was the bishop of Rome, and we know roughly when the shepherd was written. I don't have those dates myself.
It says on the last page.
Okay.
7D. This would be Pius I, bishop of Rome, from about 142 to 157.
Okay, thank you. The middle of the second century.
The reason I saw that was because I was wondering if this Pius would be Pius I. Curiosity.
Mm-hmm. That's what it says. This would be Pius I. So, this other set of canon lists, as I said, it's not comprehensive. It does not include what Irenaeus or Tertullian or Origen had to say in the time between the Muratorian canon and Eusebius. This is mostly canons after Eusebius, with the exception of the first one. The first one, we don't know exactly when it was written. Internal evidence suggests around 300 AD, maybe. But it lists out Matthew, John, Mark, Luke, Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, 1 and 2 Timothy, Titus, Colossians, Philemon, 1 Peter with a dash next to it, 2 Peter, James, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, Jude, Barnabas with a dash, Revelation, Acts, Shepherd with a dash, Acts of Paul with a dash, Apocalypse of Peter with a dash. We presume that the dash next to 1 Peter is simply to indicate that we're done with Paul and we're moving on to other people. And that the dashes next to Barnabas, Shepherd, Acts of Paul, and Apocalypse of Peter are meant to indicate that these are disputed. One presumes that. One does not actually know that. The canon of Cyril of Jerusalem, about 350 AD, he writes of the New Testament, there are four Gospels only, and the rest have false titles and are harmful. The Manichaeans also wrote a Gospel according to Thomas, which, being smeared with the fragrance of the name Gospel, destroys the souls of those who are rather simple-minded. Receive also the Acts of the 12 Apostles, and in addition to these, the seven Catholic epistles of James, Peter, John, and Jude. Okay, so James, 1 and 2 Peter, 1 and 2, 3 John, Jude. And as a seal upon them all, and the latest work of disciples, the 14 epistles of Paul. So that includes Hebrews. But let all the rest be put aside in a secondary rank. Whatever books are not read in the churches, do not read these, like those Gospel of Thomas and stuff, do not read those even by yourself, as you have already heard me say concerning the Old Testament Apocrypha. Don't read those. Okay, there's another canon list from about 360. Lists Matthew, Mark, John, Luke, 13 epistles of Paul, Acts, Revelation, 3 epistles of John, one only. It's an incomplete line. Presumably it's talking about James. 2 epistles of Peter, one only. Presumably Jude. Okay, so that, or one of those could be Hebrews. Hebrews isn't mentioned there. The canon of Athanasius in 367, he writes, the four Gospels, according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, After these, the Acts of the Apostles and Epistles called Catholic of the Seven Apostles. So of James 1, of Peter 2, of John 3. After these, one of Jude. In addition, there are 14 epistles of Paul the Apostle written in this order. First to the Romans, two to the Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, two to the Thessalonians, Hebrews, two to Timothy, Titus, and lastly Philemon. And besides, the revelation of John. These are fountains of salvation, that he who thirsts may be satisfied with the living words they contain. In these alone, the teaching of godliness is proclaimed. Let no one add to these. Let nothing be taken away from them. There's a pretty definitive statement. And if I'm not mistaken, that entirely matches our New Testament canon.
Yes, it does.
367. Athanasius had strong feelings about this. Right. The apostolic canons, so-called, written about 380. Let the following books be esteemed venerable and holy by all of those, both clergy and laity. The four Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the 14 epistles of Paul, two epistles of Peter, three of John, one of James, one of Jude, two epistles of Clement, and the constitutions dedicated to you, the bishops, by me, Clement, in eight books, which it is not appropriate to make public before all because of the mysteries contained in them. And the Acts of Us, the Apostles. Okay, so this is actually a forgery written in the name of the apostles, but it lists all of the books of our New Testament with a couple of extras thrown in.
He's tooting his own horn.
He's tooting his own horn a little bit. Again, the first letter of Clement actually was held in extremely high regard in the early church. Clement was a disciple of Paul and Peter, and he wrote his letter to the Corinthians before John wrote his stuff. Okay, next is the canon of Gregory of Nazianzus. He lived 329 to 389. No idea when. I have no idea when this was written, but it's somewhere in that time range. Matthew, indeed, wrote for the Hebrews the wonderful works of Christ. And Mark, this is a poem. Gregory of Nazianzus wrote this in iambic meter, and I have mashed it all together into a single paragraph. Matthew, indeed, wrote for the Hebrews the wonderful works of Christ. And Mark for Italy, Luke for Greece. John, the great preacher for all, walking in heaven. Then the Acts of the Wise Apostles, and 14 epistles of Paul. And seven Catholic, of which James is one, two of Peter, three of John again, and Jude's is the seventh. You have all. If there is any besides these, it is not among the genuine. So no revelation there. The canon of Amphilochius of Iconium, about 394 AD. It is time for me to speak of the books of the New Testament. Receive only four evangelists, Matthew, then Mark, to whom, having added Luke as third, count John as fourth in time, but first in height of teachings. For I call this one rightly a son of thunder, sounding out most greatly with the word of God. This, by the way, is also a poem written in iambic verse. And so that's why it's a little bit more stilted language. And receive also the second book of Luke, that of the Catholic Acts of the Apostles. Next, the chosen vessel, the herald of the Gentiles, the Apostle Paul, having written wisely to the churches twice seven epistles. That's 14, for those of you who are math challenging. To the Romans, one, to which one must add two to the Corinthians. That to the Galatians, that to the Ephesians, after which that to Philippi. Then the one written to the Colossians, two to the Thessalonians, two to Timothy, and to Titus, and to Philemon. One each, and one to the Hebrews. But some say the one to the Hebrews is spurious. Not saying well, for the grace is genuine. Well, what remains? Of the Catholic epistles, some say we must receive seven. But others say only three should be received, that of James, one, one of Peter, those of John, one. And some receive three of John, and besides these, two of Peter, and that of Jude, a seventh. And again, the revelation of John. Some approve, but the most say is spurious. This is perhaps the most reliable canon of the divinely inspired scriptures. Kind of interesting there. And finally, the Third Synod of Carthage in 397, presided over, I believe, by St. Augustine. Besides the canonical scriptures, nothing shall be read in church under the name of divine scriptures. So again, there's this distinction between what's allowed to be read in church and what's not. Moreover, the canonical scriptures are these: the Gospels, 4 books; the Acts of the Apostles, 1 book; the Epistles of Paul, 13. Of the same to the Hebrews, 1 epistle. So he's kind of saying Paul wrote Hebrews, but kind of not. Of Peter, 2. Of John the Apostle, 3. Of James, 1. Of Jude, 1. The Revelation of John. So again, exactly matching our New Testament. Yeah. Was that a comment or
on the revelation?
So there you have it. Most of these lists are after the Council of Nicaea. It is true. In a way, it helps to debunk the idea that the Council of Nicaea is where the canon got officially canonized, because even after the Council of Nicaea, people were still having some disagreements. Okay, the Council of Nicaea did not lay down what the canonical books were. It is after Christianity became legal, and then the official religion of the Roman Empire, that most of these canons get written down. It was at that time that people started figuring out that, okay, we really need to write down what are the canonical books and get this sorted out. Most of them, over there, on that board, the 4 Gospels, Acts, Paul, 1 John, 1 Peter, those were all agreed upon very, very early on. And then the other ones are the ones that continue to be discussed. Even into the time of the Reformation, I mean, Luther opened that can of worms with James in particular, right? We will see next time, as we look at Irenaeus and Origen and Tertullian, how the heretics of the 2nd and 3rd centuries were another influence that got the Christian leaders of the time saying to themselves, we need to specify what are the actual canonical books of the New Testament, because Marcion and Valentinus and Basilides and all these other guys are making up this crazy stuff and selling it as apostolic. And so they don't so much explicitly say, these are the books of the New Testament. But what they do talk about is, what is it that makes a book of the New Testament canonical? What are the qualifications? And they talk about, a lot of it is the apostolic authorship. That is a lot of it. The apostles were the eyewitnesses to Christ. They are the ones who preached the gospel to the whole world. And they are the ones who wrote down, for the church's benefit, the gospels and the acts and the letters. These are the books that are authoritative in the church. It is apostolic authority, with 3 exceptions. Mark, who from very early on is defended as having the stamp of approval of Peter. Luke, who from very early on is defended as having the stamp of approval of Paul, both for the gospel and for Acts. Hebrews, which very early on is defended as being so obviously great theology and totally in agreement with anything that Paul might have said. So it's as good as having been written by Paul. That's the opinion of the early church from very early times. And so much so that, as you saw, people start associating Hebrews with Paul and listing it as among Paul's letters. We had an ACG study here a year or two ago about Hebrews, and there was lots of fun back and forth between people who thought that Paul must have written Hebrews and people who thought Paul didn't write Hebrews. My own opinion is that Paul is the best, most likely candidate we have for the author of Hebrews, but he's also not likely to have been the author of Hebrews. But it's such a good book. So anyway, those were the main exceptions to the apostolic authorship criterion, and they all were associated with apostles from very early on. Yeah?
These canons that we went over on the back, they're all about the same time period, late 300s.
Mm-hmm.
Geographically, were they close? Did they know they were coming up with these at the same time? Were they separate things coming up? Were they corresponding?
Well, let's see here. Carthage is in northern Africa. Gregory of Nazianzus was in Turkey. Iconium, I think, is in Turkey, isn't it? Maybe. Athanasius was...
Iconium's Greece.
Or Iconium might be Greece. Okay. Athanasius, I think, is sort of all over the place. He did a lot of traveling,
yeah,
as I recall. Cyril of Jerusalem, that's Jerusalem. But I'm glad you brought that up, because next time we'll talk about Irenaeus, Origen, and Tertullian in particular. They are 2nd, 3rd century, and they represent large geographical regions, pretty much the whole Christian world.
Gotcha.
So, but with this grouping that you had, mm-hmm, you've got Europe, Asia, Africa,
yeah,
which was the extent of Christendom at that point,
yeah,
pretty much. So, yeah.
Cool.
So, yeah. Oh, yeah, you had a question or comment.
So if they don't think Paul wrote Hebrews, uh-huh, who do they think wrote Hebrews?
Nobody.
It's in the Bible. It's in the canon. So.
Yeah. Nobody in the early church knew.
Okay.
Yeah. Some people in the early church suggested maybe Barnabas wrote it, maybe Luke wrote it, or maybe Paul wrote it and Luke translated it into Greek from Hebrew. Maybe Clement wrote it, but probably not. Those are sort of the early theories.
Even if Luke or Barnabas, it kind of connects with Paul.
Yeah, exactly.
Along his teachings and his line of teachings.
Yeah, so if the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of Luke, written by Luke, are good for apostolic authority, suppose Luke wrote Hebrews, it ought to be good for apostolic authority as well, in theory, or something like that. Yeah.
This goes back to my last question, but were these written in different languages, or was there an ecclesiastical language that was set in place? Like, I don't think Latin would have been.
Some of these... would have been written in Greek, and some of them would have been written in Latin. So the Synod of Carthage, I'm pretty sure that would have been written in Latin. Gregory of Nazianzus, I'm pretty sure would have written in Greek. Same with Athanasius. The Muratorian canon is written in Latin, but here's another problem with it is that it probably was originally written in Greek. But maybe not. Well, no, maybe not, because it's supposed to be from around Rome. So it could have been in Latin. Eusebius was written in Greek. But I think, I'm not sure that we actually have Greek copies of Eusebius. We might only have Latin translations of Eusebius' Greek church history.
Gotcha.
I might be making that up. Yeah, it's just, the church became a Latin-speaking church,
right,
and the Greek stuff sort of, nobody was able to read it anymore, and they kind of got lost. Which is why, after the printing press was developed, invented, and Erasmus decided he was going to publish a printed copy of the Greek New Testament, he had a total of like 6 or 7 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. And that didn't even give the complete New Testament. He had to do some back translations from Latin into Greek in order to fill in the holes. The Greek wasn't around. At least not in Western Europe. So. It is after 8:30, so we should probably officially end it. I can stick around if anybody wants to chat about other stuff, or if you want to take a look at the books. I didn't say anything heretical, did I, Pastor? I guess I shouldn't leave you hanging. Personally, I am very happy with the New Testament that we have as canonical. I do not think that...
Now you're off the hook.
Thank you. That the disputed books that are in our New Testament should not be there. I think they should be there. There we go. Okay. So next time we'll talk about heresies and how they impacted the development of canon. And then Bob will end us on a more positive, non-heretical note. 2 weeks after that. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this Trinity Fellowship at Indiana University event. For more information about the Trinity Fellowship, please visit our website at tfiu.org.